from WJFF in Jeffersonville. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, we'll check in with the student journalists of Manner, Inc. OC Helper, editor-in-chief, will join us live on the phone, and we'll talk about some of their stories. Manner, Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported monthly newspaper published by the Livingston Manor Free Library. And on today's show, we'll talk about a new approach to learning at Livingston Manor Central Schools, the debates students are holding, formal debates on free speech, eminent domain, and other issues. And Michelle Adams-Thomas speaks to innovative artist Derek Mailander, who's also the Catskill Art Society artist in residence. We'll also get an update on some of the political stories later in the half hour from New York State, from Karen DeWitt in Albany. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says diplomatic efforts are underway to evacuate the remaining fighters holed up beneath the Azovstal steel plant in the devastated city of Mariupol. In his latest video address, Zelensky said influential intermediaries are involved. He did not provide further details. Yesterday, 50 more civilians were evacuated, and more are set to leave today. Experts estimate that Ukraine has sustained about $92 billion U.S. dollars worth of physical damage since the start of the war. NPR's Anya Kamenets reports from Ukraine that people are being encouraged to submit their own evidence of the destruction.
Maxim Nefodov of the Kyiv School of Economics announced on Friday that the housing sector has seen the most damage in dollar terms, simply because there's so much of it. But, he says, hundreds of bridges, schools, hospitals, warehouses, and factories have been damaged and destroyed as well. Along with information compiled from drones, satellite imagery, and media reports, there is a website where anyone can upload photos and other information about lost assets in hopes of having Russia one day pay reparations. Anya Kamenets, NPR News, Lviv, Ukraine.
North Korea has tested what appears to be a submarine-launched ballistic missile. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports on the North's 15th missile test so far this year.
South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says it detected the launch from waters off the East Coast seaport of Sinpo. The missile flew about 370 miles at a maximum altitude of 37 miles. It's not clear if it was launched from a sub or an underwater platform. Pyongyang is still in the process of miniaturizing nuclear warheads to put on its missiles. It hasn't detonated an atomic bomb since 2017, but the State Department says it's making preparations at its Punggye-ri underground test site. It estimates that North Korea could conduct its seventh nuclear test as early as this month. President Biden is due to meet here with South Korea's new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, on the 21st of this month. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Extreme temperatures, strong winds expected to return to New Mexico as firefighters battle wildfires across the southwest, the largest near Las Vegas and northern New Mexico. From member station KSFR in Santa Fe, Kevin Mearshart reports.
The Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak fire has been burning for a month. It started when a prescribed burn by the U.S. Forest Service jumped its parameters due to high winds. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is warning anyone still in evacuation areas that conditions could change so fast it'll make leaving or rescue impossible.
I know that folks want me to give you unequivocally that the fire lines will hold, that it's not going to jump, that we're not going to lose a single person or a single structure. That's what I want, but we won't know until we know.
President Joe Biden declared New Mexico a disaster area on Thursday. FEMA officials are on the ground assisting local and state personnel. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Mearshart in Santa Fe. Hey,
this is NPR. A natural gas leak is being blamed for an explosion at a five-star hotel in Cuba's capital. The blast killed at least 22 people and injured dozens. Havana's governor says no tourists were staying at the hotel because it was undergoing renovations, but officials say about a dozen people remain missing. Afghanistan's Taliban leadership now says Afghan women must cover their faces. The Taliban issued a decree today saying the ideal face covering is a head-to-toe burqa, saying it's respectful and part of tradition. The decree warns that a woman's father or closest male relative could be imprisoned or fired from the government jobs if she does not cover her face outside the home. Britain's heritage organization, the National Trust, trying to decide what to do about a makeshift memorial for a character from one of the Harry Potter books. Vicky Barker reports from London.
When Dobby the house elf is murdered by Death Eaters in the final book of the series, Harry Potter himself conducts his funeral. Now, the Welsh beach where the scene was filmed has become a place of pilgrimage for Harry Potter fans, and an impromptu memorial cairn has sprung up, which thousands visit each year, many leaving painted stones or socks in tribute. Non-Dobby fans, though, call the cairn an eyesore that's caused crowding and litter on a protected beach. Now, Britain's National Trust is soliciting the public's opinion on whether the cairn should be moved, with feelings running high on both sides. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
And I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities to break down barriers and prepare all people for success in their jobs and careers as employees or entrepreneurs. More online at kauffman.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The first Saturday of every month, we regularly bring you Manor Inc. stories, and this Saturday is no exception, except it's a special edition. We have the editor of Manor Inc., O.C. Helper, live on the phone with us. Good morning, O.C., how are you?
I'm doing great, how are you?
I'm okay. A bit of the sniffles this morning, but otherwise I'm good. thanks for joining us live, and is this your final issue as editor? Are you graduating soon?
I am graduating soon, but this isn't my final issue. I think I have a few more issues over the summer, probably June and July. But after that, I got to get ready to head off to college in August.
That's great. Where are you headed?
I'm headed to SUNY Cortland.
That's great. We'll talk a little bit more about being the editor of Manor Inc., but let's get to your first story. It's the cover story this issue this month about a unique way of learning that your social studies teacher, Joseph Clark, wanted to give to your students.
Yeah. As recently we started doing debates in our class, it started in second semester when we went from economics into government. So from that, when we started learning about the different amendments, he started having us do deeper research into like a specific topic or issue that was happening that related to one of the amendments we were learning about. So for the first one that we were doing, we were talking about whether or not music can like influence you and like make you do bad decisions or bad things. And that was what the first debate was about. But the second one is where we're talking about eminent domain. And I personally think it went a lot better than the first one. It was a lot closer, an argument, and the arguments were pretty well fleshed out, and it was all in all a pretty good one.
Yeah, so you had a little practice. So we have an excerpt of the eminent domain debate. Now, this is the group that's arguing for it. So we'll play that, and we'll talk a little bit more.
Hello, my fellow classmates and future citizens of America. I'm here with my others to prove why eminent domain should remain. So, eminent domain, what we get out of it is they build highways, they get railroads, they build other airports for us to use, easier, more convenient travel. They also have supply water. They construct public buildings like post offices, all the government buildings, aid and defense readiness, just in case if we were in a war, they would need some more property for aid defense. And they also build more hospitals and healthcare buildings to closer areas and make it more faster for ambulances to get there. This is important because the government isn't just going around taking people's property because they feel like it. They're taking it for the public good. The public needs to benefit from this. And when they do take your property, you get something in return. You get compensated for it. They give you, usually it's the bare market value. But the property has, traditional meaning for you. They actually give you extra money for that, too, if it's, a family-owned business. Some court cases we got is Cole versus United States. The United States sees some of its property to build more public buildings, like government buildings and post offices. He used this he actually challenged the U.S. saying that it was not constitutionally right to do that, which the court ruled that it was right because it benefited the good and he also got compensated for his property. Justin William Strong emphasized that federal government's eminent domain power was essential to its independent existence and perpetuity. That word. Okay, our next court case, this is probably one of the strongest ones, is Kelo versus New London. In this case, they went to a... I'll just read it for you. In this case, the city authorized the use of eminent domain to revitalize its distressed economy. The city council allowed a nonprofit to exercise eminent domain in the city's name. The court allowed this because it was a part of a development plan designed to benefit the public. So, this company was going bankrupt, and the government bought the property to continue its funds, and it opened up many more job opportunities for it, and many more, it just boosted the economy. And they also got compensated for it too. They didn't just steal their property. Our conclusion, eminent domain is essential to keeping our country running. Without eminent domain, we would have way less highways, way less airports, way less hospitals, way less water supply, way less of everything, honestly, if we weren't allowed to take some of the private property and use it to public good. Although there may be some flaws in eminent domain, like some abuses, it is still completely necessary to keep our country running. The end.
Those were students in Livingston Manor social studies teacher Joseph Clark's class on a debate about eminent domain. Those were students that were for it. O.C. Helper, the editor of Manor, Inc., has the cover story about those debates that are now being featured in that class. I guess your teacher, Mr. Clark, wanted folks to get a chance to see both sides of an argument and try to be civil with one another. So do you think that that's happening, O.C.?
Yeah, definitely. Well, at least in the beginning of it, it was pretty civil, especially when everyone was just having their own like sections where they were explaining their arguments. Even the back and forth arguments that we had later were pretty civil. Because, you know, we're all friends here. We all share the same classes. So it's pretty easy to, like, just keep everything civil and let each other talk, not talk over each other, let each other explain our arguments. And I think it's actually been really effective in helping us see that there are always two sides to an argument.
Exactly. This is Radio Chatskill. If you're just joining us, it's the Manor, Inc. edition, a special Manor, Inc. edition. Live on the phone, O.C. Helper, editor of Manor, Inc., is joining us. And let's move to one of your other stories, a feature story that Michelle Adams-Thomas has in this issue. She's speaking to the Catskill Art Society Artist in Residence. That's Derek Maylander, whose work promotes kindness and respect, he says, and... Here's Michelle Adams-Thomas from Manor, Inc. and their conversation.
It's really about making great art that excites people and inspires them, makes them think, and helps them move toward kindness, respect, and fairness. That's really kind of like my really high-level kind of aspirational goal for my art. But then on a in terms of my personality, when I neglect my art practice, I get kind of weird. So I start trying to turn my day job into an art project, or I try to turn my husband into an art project. I generally, of course, it's always a miserable failure, and I drive people crazy in the process.
Very understandable. When did you know you wanted to be an artist? Like, when did you know it's the thing you wanted for your life?
You know, it's funny. I think that I have a really distinct memory of being a young kid. Probably I was maybe 7 or 8, and my parents were having a little cocktail party, and one of the adults came over to me and said, "Well, little Derek, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And I remember looking at them with contempt and saying, "I'm going to be an artist." And the reason I remember this is because everyone laughed and I was embarrassed because I embarrassed them. And because my response was so kind of I think contempt is really the best word for it. My voice was just like dripping with consent, because for some reason I kind of assumed that at age 7, people could just take one look at me and they would know, obviously, that I was going to be an artist. You know, I just thought, like, can't you tell? Mm-hmm. Isn't it just oozing out of every pore? So I think I always knew, but then actually right around your, at the age that you are now, Michelle, I gave it up. And really it was because it had gotten too scary. I don't think I had a very thick skin, and I didn't have very good self-esteem. And so adults were starting to kind of, descend with their, concern for me and my ability to feed and clothe myself as an adult, and started planting seeds of doubt about being an artist. Like, they would started asking questions like, how will you make a living? And, it's not enough to be, talented. There's a dearth of talented artists in New York. How's your work going to be better? You know, and I could barely function in the world, you know, and I was mostly just going around trying to be invisible and not get beat up. So to have adults asking me questions like that was not helpful. My school was really bad, and especially the arts part. Actually, no, it stunk all around. But in the art classes, I was so deeply into it and so dedicated that I was making for example, in my pottery class, I was making Egyptian hieroglyphic inspired relief sculptures of like figures like walking with like Great Danes at their ankles, you know, and my fellow students were making pinch pots, and I was, in a sense, I don't know if you know much about like the bell curve when it comes to grading, but like if you've got 10 students making pinch pots, you know, and there's kind of like the best pinch pot is kind of at the top of the bell curve. And then the middle pinch pot, the decent one, is kind of at the middle, and that gets a C. And then there'll be a few A's on the other side of the bell curve. Those are the people who are making the really beautiful pinch pot. And then on the other side of the bell curve will be the D's, the students who are making really terrible pinch pots. Because they were all making pinch pots, and I was making Egyptian inspired relief sculpture. I was an A+, and that pushed everyone else into the C department, because my stuff was so much better that it was making everyone else's work look really terrible and lame. And so they started just to destroy my work.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So like we could bring in like a Tupperware container and put your clay work in there and seal it up so that it wouldn't dry out, so you could work on it the next day. And I'd come to school and open up my Tupperware, and my piece would be smashed. So,
oh my and God. I didn't,
it was awful. And I didn't, and I was so insecure, and I was just trying not to get beat up, that I just decided to just stop making art. So, and no one, yeah. So there's my sob story. The upside is that when I was in my mid-20s, through the good influence of my parents and some serendipity, I ended up doing some really great, deep spiritual work. And at that point, I felt strong enough and secure enough to reengage with my art career. And within a year, I applied to art school, and I went to School of Visual Arts for my BA, and from there on, I just continued with art. So there is a happy ending, but I tell that story especially to you, Michelle, because it can be hard as a young person to pursue art.
Oh, I've already heard enough about that.
I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry to hear that.
I'm very, very happy that you told me that story. My next question, I was going to ask where you're from. Usually when I do artists, they're not usually from Livingston Manor. So I guess a little bio about where you're from.
Sure. I usually, when I meet people, I say I'm from Alter Ridge, upstate New York. And then they say, where's that? And I say, well, it's just right outside of Malta. And then they say, well, where's that? And they say, well, it's the closest big town is Balsam Spa. That's where I went to high school. And then they say, where's that? And I say, well, that's near Saratoga Springs where Skidmore College is and their racetrack is. And they're like, I think I've heard of that. And then I say, well, that's about 45 minutes north of Albany. And then they go, oh, okay. Way up there. So, grew up on a dirt road, and back in the late 70s, I graduated in 83. So probably like in about 1979, pretty much the only thing that existed in, Malta was a Stewart's, grocery store, a Methodist church, a small bank, a restaurant that I don't know anyone who ever went there, and then two hot dog stands across the street from each other. Dueling hot dog stands. Yeah, they both had big, beautiful neon signs of giant neon hot dogs. Well, one of them had a giant neon hot dog. That's the one I really remember. I think that was probably the one that survived the longest. But then I think they both kind of got put out of business by the A&W drive-in root beer restaurant.
Nostalgic.
It was very sweet, but I guess the comparison, if we had to compare it to a town upstate, maybe it would be the equivalent of Hortonville, or maybe it would be maybe a little bit like Jeff. Jeff has a lot more storefronts than Malta did, but Jeff's kind of coming up, but for a while Jeff really did seem to be like the gas station, the PEX, yeah. and maybe you could get your hair cut somewhere. It was kind of really just about gutted out. There was kind of nothing for a while.
So as an artist myself, I usually like making art. I notice people have their own thoughts about it or what the meaning behind it is. So in your own words, how would you describe the meaning behind your art or your art in general?
I would say the meaning behind my art. I really do always go back to something that my art teacher at SVA, Alice Acock, said to me, which was, she didn't go into the quagmire of trying to define art, but she did say that art is about communication. And I believe that. And so whenever I create work, I am very consciously thinking about how will this communicate. And so when I exhibit work, I'm very carefully paying attention to how the work communicates. Do people get what I hope they're getting from it? If not, are they getting something meaningful from it at least? You know, is it evoking an emotional response from them? You know, are they connecting with the work? Is it ultimately communicating? That's really how I approach everything I do.
I think that's a great way to look at it, because as a photographer as well, I'm doing classes and they teach me how different people would view my art. So I think that's amazing.
Oh, that's nice. They talked to you about that.
Mm-hmm. We are doing an exhibit at the end of our class, and I've never had pieces really on exhibit before, so it'll be an interesting experience. Wow.
I would encourage you to be there for the whole opening, and and try to pay attention to what people are, how people are responding to your work. Are they, you know, you'll have a room of other things of art. You know, which artworks are people drawn to? Which artworks are people spending time with? You know, and talk to people, see if you can figure out what it is that's working and what isn't working, or why people are interested in it, you know, in this piece versus that piece, you know?
Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also, if I may offer another piece of advice, I know you didn't ask for advice though.
It's amazing. I love your advice.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Well, I would say if you see someone lingering by your art, don't be afraid to go over and interrupt them or talk to them, because you know, I think it's nice not to pounce. You want to give people some time to be with the work and to let the work unfold for them. But maybe if you see they're kind of maybe about to move on, it's a nice time to jump in and be like, "Hi, I'm the artist." I think we think that maybe we're being pushy, or that we're interrupting, or that I don't know, maybe we think we're being aggressive, but actually people really like to meet artists, and they really like to talk to artists in general. And so I think they'll be happy if you do that, and it'll give you an opportunity to talk to them about the work and, you know, try to understand what they're seeing, how the work is for them through their eyes. You know,
I'll definitely try it.
You know, like, hi, I noticed you were looking at my photograph, and I thought I'd introduce myself. I'm so-and-so, and I'm Michelle. And then see what they say, you know, and then if they don't say much, you can say like, do you have any thoughts about the photo? And just, you know, as simple as that, you know, you might be surprised with what you hear. They might have a reaction that's different than what you were expecting.
Thank you. Your advice is very much appreciated.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I think it'll be nice. I think you might enjoy that too.
Mm-hmm. All right. I had one more question left. I've seen so many pictures of your art. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Plan on going to see it at the exhibit in town.
Oh, good.
I was wondering how you make your pieces, and I see they're made out of clothes. I'm just wondering the process in which they're made.
Sure. It depends to some extent on the project. Sometimes I make works for, it's almost like an event. And I mean, it is an event, and it's durational, but like I'll sometimes have an organization reach out to me and say, we want to work with you for an exhibition that'll be up for 1 month. And maybe it's something that's across the country. It's not always practical for me to make something and transport it across country, and install it. And then also, after the show, I don't necessarily always have storage for something, especially if I'd like to work big, which I often do like to work big. So with projects that are really like event based like that, I'll often, work in a way where I don't need to build the piece for longevity for the ages. I just need to build the piece so that it will look good for a month. And so that affects how I'll approach the piece. In those cases, I'll often, if I'm going to make something big that's far away, I will often there's a lot of planning involved up front, a lot of strategy and planning, kind of like almost like you're going to produce a movie or something. And there's a lot of coordination with the organization, and then you'll often only have a couple weeks to make a piece that's often very big and complicated. And so you have to have everything worked out in advance. You have to order all your materials so that they're there waiting for you on day one. So it's a lot of planning, and then I'll work with volunteers. And so I'll have like day one training. I'll train people. I'll explain to people the goals of the project. I'll show people renderings and then work. And then I'm ultimately buzzing around working with a dozen or even more people and fabricating the piece on site.
This is Radio Chatskill, the Manor Inc. edition. That was a conversation that Manor Inc.'s Michelle Adams Thomas had with Derek Mielander, who was the artist in residence at the Catskill Art Society in Livingston Manor in March and April, and is featured in the current issue of Manor Inc. The editor-in-chief of Manor Inc. is joining us again. O.C. Helper is on the phone. Hi, O.C.
Hello.
And in addition to being the editor-in-chief, OC also writes the Media Probe column. That is your review column, right?
Yes.
Okay. And what are you reviewing this month?
So this month I'm reviewing a TV show called Heartstopper that recently came out on Netflix.
Okay. So let's hear your review.
All right. So whenever I watch a teen romance, drama, comedy, I always immediately lower my standards and expectations. That is a result of the massive amounts of terrible shows under this combined genre that there are. But I've been hearing about a new Netflix show that was getting a lot of hype called Heartstopper, and it's based off a webcomic. I didn't think much of it, but thought I'd check it out once it dropped. I'd completely forgotten about it until one of my best friends started talking about it on social media. So I binged the show all in one night, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So here's my spoiler-free review. The best word to describe the show is honestly adorable. All the little platonic and romantic interactions between the characters warmed even my calloused heart from all of the gory martial arts action movies I've seen. The characters themselves were all super well-developed and unique. No person was the same, and they all had different shortcomings. It felt like some weren't shown proper attention, but this is only the first season, and there's more to uncover. Another thing that I really liked about the show was how well they were able to shape the atmosphere. The poppy teen music immerses you into the lives of these kids and complements the decorative visual effects. Things like flower petals, warm breezes, lighting changes, and bright sound effects really, well, cuten up the scenes and show the sparks in relationship developments and character emotions. I haven't read much of the webcomic, but the show was able to express those comic style elements excellently. I think there are too many teen shows that try to be overly dark, edgy, and depressing. Something idealized, fun, cute, and with many LGBTQIA+ characters is extremely refreshing. And Heartstopper is exactly that. As a result, it was just really nice to watch. I rate Heartstopper a solid 9 out of 10 stars. It's not perfect television, but it's very close, and I can see myself rewatching the show many times over. I definitely suggest you give the series a look.
O.C. Helper, editor-in-chief of Manor Inc. and also the columnist, reviewer of Media Probe. I know that when you review your shows or movies, you do have a disdain for a lot of those teen rom-com films.
Yeah.
It's good you found one you like.
Yeah, definitely. And they, a lot of times, like, they're all like the same, like, cookie cutter kind of form, and it's like the same type of comedy, the same type of characters, the same type of relationships, and all the same problems. that they have over and over and over again, and there's nothing really new. And I feel like a lot of that is just, it gets boring and annoying and super repetitive, and like it's not even super realistic, so I don't see the point.
Yeah, it's insulting your intelligence as a viewer too.
Yeah, it's kind of annoying. There haven't been many that I enjoy, but there's this one long running Canadian show called Degrassi that spanned for like decades.
Yeah,
and I actually really like that one. They reuse a lot of the same plot points, but they do it in a way that's fun and interesting with new characters. And it's like a kid show, but it tackles tough subjects and topics, but they do it in a really good way.
Yeah. And one of the other regular features you have in Manor Inc. every month is your letter from the editor. And what's your letter from the editor now? Would you read it for us?
Yeah, go ahead. So specifically today, I wanted to discuss the importance of representation in media. For many folks, I grew up seeing people that look like them on all the shows and movies they watched, it doesn't seem like too much of a big deal. But for those who didn't, people of color, disabled people, queer people, you notice that with the little representation there was, she was always subpar, always side character, villain, stereotypes, and caricatures. As of more recent years, the representation has gotten far better, but with tons of pushback. People complaining about diversity just for diversity's sake, or rebranding characters as different races, genders, or sexualities. But they don't understand. They don't understand what it was like to never see your face on TV. They don't understand how these marginalized groups have been portrayed in films by people who are not them. And they especially don't understand how damaging the negative portrayals can be. So that's why movies like Black Panther and shows like Heartstopper are so important. It normalizes us and gives us a face to relate to.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill, the Manor Inc. edition. That's OC Helper, the editor-in-chief of Manor Inc. OC, before we go, I just want to ask you what your year's been like being the editor-in-chief in addition to, you know, being the editor-in-chief. You're a high school senior and you've got a lot of other things on your plate. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going good, honestly. Lately, I've just been so busy that whenever it's time for me to write up my article, it's always on deadline, right? Right as David is literally piecing the paper together, I'm sitting on my computer in my bed, just typing away at my screen. So it hasn't been easy because there's been a lot of things to do. I've been worrying about college and so many other things, like finishing up my school year and just like leaving behind a lot of my friends and things like that. Along with Manor Inc. being the editor-in-chief is something that's pretty time-consuming. So it's been a lot, but it's been pretty rewarding too.
Will you be pursuing journalism at SUNY Cortland?
That's not what my planned major is. I'm planning majoring in physical education, and I might double major with exercise science. But the college, I'm pretty sure, does have its own newspaper and newsletter. And if I do find that I have enough time with my busy schedule, I think I will work at the paper with my previous experience and everything, because I do enjoy journalism. There's just something about being able to talk to so many people and being able to find and figure out all these different stories and being able to spread it and share it.
Yeah. And you guys do such a great job, student journalists of Manor Inc., you and the whole team there. You also have some mentors that help you out. Do you want to name those folks?
Yeah. There's David Dan, who's our production editor. There's Amy Hines, who's our liaison and everything with all the with our money and grants and things. There's Art Steinhauer, who's not only just a mentor, but also helps a lot with the advertisements. And then there's other mentors like Kelly Busta, Mara Furestein, Audrey Garl, Patrick George, Daniel Morrison, and Diana Frenberg, who is also who also works at the school from time to time as a substitute teacher. And we also have, I don't know if she's still like a part, 100% a part of Manor Inc., but she's still helpful to us. Jessica Mall, who also works at the school as the high school art teacher.
And you can find more information about Manor Inc. at manorinc.org. The current issue is out now. OC Helper, you said you're going to be graduating soon, but you're going to continue this summer with a few more issues. So we'll hear from you again in the coming months then, huh?
Yeah.
All right, great. We look forward to hearing from you next month, and good luck with graduation and your final senior year stuff.
All right, thank you.
All right, have a great Saturday. We'll talk to you later.
You too. Bye.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll be back with some political news. New York major stories coming in this district of ours, New York 19, all collided this past week. We'll check in with Karen DeWitt from the New York Public Media Exchange in Albany. We'll be right back.
On the next Folk Plus, I'll be airing artists that listeners have brought to my attention, such as Billy Marlowe,
the silent fear of the warden's men, guard the cold steel
and Emily Scott Robinson.
She was in the kitchen making lunches, and the kids were in their beds. And in a flash, we lost you to the war inside your head.
Hear more on the next Folk Plus.
I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character, and this Saturday my guest will be Narrowsburg's own Jane Luxinger. Jane is a community heartbeat, helping to keep the pulse of Narrowsburg strong and thriving. Tune in Saturday at 11:30 to hear Jane talk about her life, her dreams, and more on Catskill Character, Saturday on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Two of the biggest political stories in New York State converged right here in the Radio Catskill listening area this past week. The first issue is redistricting. In February, the Democratic Party-controlled State Senate and Assembly both passed a bill for new congressional districts following the 2020 census. Immediately after Governor Kathy Hochul signed the bill into law, it was challenged in court by voters who claimed the legislature violated the state constitution by drawing gerrymandered districts. Last week, the New York State Court of Appeals sided with those voters and overturned the congressional and state Senate maps. The other recent major story out of Albany was the departure of Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, who resigned on April 12th after being indicted on campaign finance charges. This week, after winning a legislative battle to get Benjamin off the primary ballot, Governor Hochul announced her new running mate, Congressman Antonio Delgado. Now, Delgado has been representing the New York's 19th district, which includes much of Radio Catskill's listening area, but then Sullivan County was put in a different congressional district, and that one has since been ruled unconstitutional. So what district are we even in now, and what's going on with the primaries? To help us figure this out, we turn to Karen DeWitt, Albany reporter for the New York State Public Media Exchange. Jason Dole spoke with her yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, two really tumultuous events in just the last few weeks in what has been an incredibly tumultuous year in state politics.
Yeah, and there's another hearing in the state Supreme Court that you're following right now?
That's right. As we speak, on Friday, there's a hearing in state Supreme Court in the town of Bath in Steuben County, which is in central western New York. And the hearing is for a special master who is going to draw the new congressional and Senate district lines to get some input. Now, why is he doing that? As you referred in your introduction, it's kind of a long story. And it starts in 2014. That's when voters passed a constitutional amendment to change the redistricting process. And they passed a language into the Constitution that now essentially specifically prohibits gerrymandering, saying you can't draw a district that favors an incumbent or disadvantages challengers. So that we had the 2020 census, and now the new lines had to be drawn, and this is the first time that this process occurred. It was a bipartisan commission that was supposed to draw the lines. Well, of course, because they were bipartisan, five Democrats, five Republicans, they gridlocked. They couldn't draw the lines. They had two sets of maps. So the legislature, which has a Democratic supermajority right now, drew the lines instead. Republicans sued, and the state's highest court just, was it really just last week? I think it really was just last week, said that the Democrats gerrymandered to favor Democrats, disadvantage Republicans, and they also didn't follow the new rules properly for the process. So it's back to the trial court judge in Steuben County, and he's appointed a special master. His name's Jonathan Service. He's a postdoc fellow at Carnegie Mellon Institute, and now he is going to be the one that draws the lines for all the congressional and Senate districts in New York State. It's down to this one person.
And did the court select him?
Yes, he was selected by the judge, Patrick McAllister, and he is qualified. He's an expert on redistricting. He teaches a course in it. He's actually been involved assisting other special masters around the country. So he is qualified, but it is interesting that we went from this whole process that was supposed to happen, a bipartisan commission, it was supposed to be all done really fairly, now down to one person. Oh, and I should mention, the judge also said that the congressional and Senate primaries can't be in June anymore. They have to be August 23rd in order for there to be enough time for all this redrawing of the districts, petitioning candidates off to petition again, for all of that to happen.
Okay, but Democrats are fighting to keep the primary in June, correct?
Well, yes, for now, let's say, the statewide offices for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, controller, and the state assembly are still scheduled for June 28th. But in the last few days, there's new court challenges to the assembly lines, actually from a Democrat, a businessman from the Hudson Valley, Gary Greenberg, who I believe lives in New Baltimore, and he was active in lobbying for the Child Victims Act. He is also petitioning the judges to move all the primaries to June 28th. And, this judge, Patrick McAllister, who's now where the hearing is in Steuben County, so far he's been very favorable to challengers. So we're really going to have to watch in the next couple of weeks to see, is there going to be a June 28th primary, or is everything going to be moved to August 23rd?
But so as we stand right now, understanding that things may change because this is still being heard in court, but it's looking like there's going to be two primaries possibly?
Yes, exactly. And it's going to be confusing to voters. And I know it's hard enough to vote these days and find the time. So they're going to, listeners are just going to have to stay tuned to, find out when the primaries are going to be. In fact, I know as a voter, I think I already got my little postcard saying that the primary is going to be June 28th. So hopefully they will have time, if it gets changed, to at least notify voters individually if there's a date change. But, with all of these things happening, it's anybody's guess, really, if there's going to be two primaries or one primary at this point. Nobody can say definitively.
Is that a big reason why Governor Hochul, wants the primaries to remain in June? Because the effect it'll have confusing voters, affecting turnout, or are there other motivations?
Well, that's one of the motivations. But I think that she wants to get the primary over with as quickly as possible, because the polls that come out every month show that her popularity and confidence in her governing abilities are starting to wane, and they've been waning steadily since she became a governor. There's been a lot of incidents recently, the state budget and the Buffalo Bills stadium, with $1 billion of taxpayer money going to the billionaires who run the Buffalo Bills. She had the problems with her lieutenant governor having to resign. These gerrymandered district lines that got thrown out reflect badly on her because she signed off on them, not to mention rising crime rate, inflation, ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, and there's worries that former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who resigned last August over multiple scandals, could maybe decide that he wants to enter the race if it's in August and petitioning has to begin again. So for a lot of reasons, she'd like to have two separate primaries, but I don't know if she's going to have control over that.
And as part of all that, this week she announced that she was picking, of course, after a court victory, after a legislative victory that said that she does not have to retain the now resigned former lieutenant governor, she chose Antonio Delgado, representative for New York's 19th district, picked him to be essentially her running mate as lieutenant governor. And that was just announced this week, too.
Former Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin on April 12th was indicted on federal corruption charges, and he resigned later that day. Governor Hochul convinced the legislature to change the rules to get Benjamin off the ballot, because the only way until this week that you could get off the ballot was you had to die, you had to move out of state, or run for another office. And Benjamin wasn't planning on doing any of those things. So they changed the rules to allow that if you're indicted on criminal charges or convicted of a crime, you can ask to have your name removed from the ballot. And, you know, that has not sat all that well with Hochul's political opponents, both Democrats and Republicans. So that's, you know, another thing that she's got to be worried about. But the very next day, she chose Antonio Delgado. I think it was kind of a surprise. Most of us thought she would pick somebody from the legislature, especially since Delgado holds a Democratic congressional seat, and, you know, Democrats and Republicans are really, you know, fighting to keep control of the House of Representatives. It's such a narrow margin of which party holds it that it seemed, you know, kind of curious that he would leave his seat. But the other speculation is that maybe he thought he wasn't going to win re-election and this was an easy out for him, you know, get a new job, be a lieutenant governor.
Wow. And then for us here in what was or kind of still is the 19th district, there's this added question of, well, what are we even in a district? Because the plans, the redistricted, the redrawn districts moved Sullivan County, where we are, into the 17th district, or created a 17th district. I'm not even sure what it used to be, but we would no longer be in Delgado's district. If, of course, these maps were still being used, but they were thrown out last week.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's got to be on hold about that. And also, Delgado, even though Hochul announced that he's going to be lieutenant governor, he hasn't resigned from Congress yet. He said he wasn't going to right away. So I'm not really sure of the timing of that. He said he wanted to wrap up, you know, some of his constituent work and some of the things going on in Congress, so they may be timing that you know, they can have his name out there as lieutenant governor, but that could be to do with how to have a special election, because that is a question. If he resigns today and they set a special election, you're right, where is that special election? You know, what is the district? So a lot of these things are on hold, and I think it's added to a lot of confusion that, frankly, nobody expected this to happen.
New York State has a long history of shenanigans and corruption in politics. And there was this feeling, at least between me and me, there was this feeling that when Governor Hochul came on, that she was really going to stand up to a lot of that, especially the circumstances under which she became governor, with the disgraced Governor Cuomo stepping down. Now, I mean, is she still on track to be trying to do that, or does all of this mess rest with her?
Yeah, I think all of the things that have happened has raised questions, particularly, you know, I mean, she's not accused of any wrongdoing, but people wonder what was her judgment in picking Brian Benjamin, former state senator from Harlem, as lieutenant governor, when, you know, there were some red flags about, you know, some of the things that he had done with his campaign money. He used it for gas when he wasn't supposed to pay car payments. There was an event that was or was not a wedding reception that he paid for from his campaign. He said he paid all that stuff back, and he did, but some of that stuff people say now, well, that should have raised some questions about, you know, his kind of personal ethics. So, yeah, I think it is starting to reflect on her, because, you know, first people thought, oh, well, you know, she seems very clean, and, you know, some people, you know, were happy to have a woman governor for the first time. But now I think that they're starting to question, you know, some of these things, some of these news items that are coming out. And, you know, when you're governor, you have to own it, right? You get the blame, you get the credit for anything that happens.
And what other political aspects of this are you watching as you cover Albany? What other things are you keeping an eye on related to all of this?
I don't know. I think all of this is enough right now. When the primaries are, whether Andrew Cuomo gets back into the race, you know, how this all plays out into the summer and the fall. And there is one other big one, as a matter of fact. The leaked Supreme Court opinion, and striking down Roe v. Wade, that has been another earthquake that is, you know, shaking the nation and certainly here in New York State. And how is that going to play out in elections and policies? And that is another really big one that's happening.
And in introducing Antonio Delgado as her pick for lieutenant governor, both Governor Hochul and Representative Delgado kind of came out of the gate swinging following the news of that leaked Supreme Court decision. They really and they're both rather staid politicians, but they got a little bit fiery over that.
Well, I think they feel very passionately about it. I will give them due credit for that. But it also did manage to change the subject from, oh, well, what happened to the former lieutenant governor? Oh, that's right. He's indicted. He's facing multiple corruption charges.
Absolutely. Karen DeWitt, is there anything else you want to say before we get going?
Well, I don't think so at this point, but just stay tuned because it's just, you know, it's just been crazy here in politics, and I think it's just going to be a very unstable time for politics and policy in our country. So a lot happening.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to listen to your reports coming out of Albany, and I thank you for doing that work. And I thank you for taking the time today to kind of give us an update on what there is that we know so far. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That is Jason Dole speaking to Karen DeWitt from the New York Public Radio Exchange about all of the activity in Albany in just this past week. For more on redistricting and the primaries in New York State, we have a conversation with Lori Benjamin, the Republican commissioner of Sullivan County's Board of Election. You can hear that full conversation, including more details about the upcoming primaries in Sullivan County, on Monday night on the Local Edition. That's at 6:30 on Radio Catskill. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Jeffersonville Farmers Market, featuring local farmers, producers, and purveyors. Summer Sundays, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. next to the Jeffersonville Bake Shop on Main Street. Vendor applications now being accepted online. JeffersonvilleFarmersMarket.com. From Superfine Social, custom Squarespace websites plus social media and digital marketing coaching for small business owners and community organizations. Take control of your online visibility. SuperfineSocial.com.
Hello, if you're a book reader, and even if you're not, I'd like to invite you to join me, Aaron Hicklin, every Sunday at noon for Shelf Life, on WJFF Radio Catskill, a show about books and the people who love them. Each episode, my guest picks two of their favorite books. I read them, and then we get together to talk about them. That's Shelf Life on Sundays at noon on WJFF Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we spend the hour with the iconic Evan Kleiman, arguably the inventor of the Caprese salad and pioneering food radio personality. She's the host of Good Food from KCRW. I'm such a fan. She's coming up this week on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Farm and Country is coming up next, followed by Catskill Character, The Janice Adams Show, and more locally produced programming right here on Radio Catskill. The forecast, rain, highs around 50 today with wind gusts up to 25 miles an hour, near half an inch of rainfall before the evening is over. Overcast overnight with a low of 37, partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 57.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.